This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was once one of the many thousands of undergrad students trudging around the campus at the University of Michigan. Then he tried his hand at writing. His first novel brought in a whopping 24 rejection letters, but that did not stop Brad Meltzer. His next novel became a New York Times bestseller. That was in 1997. Since then, his books consistently go right to the top of the bestseller lists. And he has fans in high places as well. How many authors are able to say they get research help from a former president of the United States? Brad Meltzer's newest political thriller, The President's Shadow, is out this week. Brad, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, so great to be here.
I would imagine that any student thinking of, I would love to be a writer, can draw a lot of hope and inspiration from your career path.
You know, it's funny, when you talk about me as a student, my mind immediately goes back to exactly that, sitting on the University of Michigan campus and just having that dream of being an author one day. And very few people know this, but every year on my birthday, that dream is so potent to me that every year on my birthday, I go back to the University of Michigan and I teach for the past, I think, 3 years now, a Skype class, an English class, and I teach an English class there. And the one thing I tell all the English students is, I'm you. I'm exactly you. I sat in Angel Hall and walked by the rock and spun the cube and went to stand at the spot at the Union where Kennedy declared the Peace Corps. I'm exactly you and you're me. So keep writing and keep writing and keep writing.
And to hear that from someone who lives at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, plus all the other things you do, has to be inspired. When and how did you feel called to be a writer?
The funny part was, I never thought I would be a writer because it wasn't a real job. It didn't exist. That's not, you know, it doesn't put dirt under your fingernails, but calluses on your hands. So I never thought of it as a job. What I knew is I had an English teacher in ninth grade who said to me, you can write. And she said, I'm going to put you in the corner for the entire year. She tried to put me in the honors class, but I had some conflict. She said, you're going to sit in the corner for the entire year, ignore every homework assignment I give, ignore everything I do at the blackboard. And what she was really saying was, you're going to thank me later. And sure enough, 10 years later, I went back to her classroom, knocked on the door, and I said, my name is Brad Meltzer, and I wrote this book, and it's for you. And my English teacher from ninth grade starts crying. And I said, why are you crying? She said, because I was going to retire this year because I didn't think I was having an impact anymore. And I said, you have 30 students. We have one teacher. And she had no idea of her impact. But it wasn't until I got to Michigan that I finally thought of it as a job, because one of my roommates in college wanted to be a cartoonist. And I was like, that's a job? You can get paid for that? And it was the first kind of person I ever met who thought he can take a creative idea and actually turn it into work. So I really do credit Michigan for that. And he's still one of my best friends today. Hmm. But it was really in Ann Arbor where that first cracked open for me.
Your first novel, as we mentioned, drew 24 rejection letters. What did it take to get past that, to say, all right, I still think I have something worthwhile, I'm going to keep writing?
There were only 20 publishers at the time. I got 24 rejection letters, right? That means some people are writing me twice to make sure I get the point. But to get past it, the honest truth is I was just stubborn and young. And I remember the week I got my 23rd and 24th rejection letter, I said, if they don't like this book, I'm going to write another. And if they don't like this book, I'm going to write another. And the week after I got my 23rd and 24th letter, I started the book that became The 10th Justice. But I will tell you, to really go to the core of your question, I don't think you're supposed to get past it. In fact, every day when I sit down to write, I have a few rituals that I kind of just do. And every day, one of the rituals that I have is I sit down and I imagine that, you know, my agent was calling me to tell me, I got two editors left who want to buy your book. And I'm going to call you at such and such a time, because we had no cell phones back then, and we're going to find out exactly how much they want to pay for it. So I stood by the phone and the phone rang and I was excited and I picked the phone up and waited for her to tell me what the offer was on my great new book. And I picked up the phone and she said to me, sorry, kiddo. And every day to this day that I sit down to write, I sit there and I imagine that moment. I imagine the phone I was holding. I imagine the room I was in. I imagine the fire station that I was looking at across the street and the balcony that was there. I imagine every detail that I can of that room. And I replay that moment where she said, sorry, kiddo. And to me, I need that moment to remind me how lucky I am every day that I have the job I have. Because if I don't remember that, I'm going to be spoiled. So I don't think it's one of those things where it's like, oh, I got past it and I should go on. I think you use that as fuel and you use that to make yourself go forward.
I'm speaking with New York Times bestselling author Brad Meltzer. His newest political thriller, The President's Shadow, is out this week. And it's the third in a series known as the Culper Ring thrillers. Brad, tell us, how would you describe the Culper Ring and where'd you get the idea for this?
A few years ago, I got a call from the Department of Homeland Security asking me to come and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? And I was like, this is – but I was honored to be part of what they call the Red Cell Program.
Was it just a brainstorming? Let's all kind of just throw it out there?
Exactly. They would pair me with a Secret Service agent and a chemist, and they would give us a target, and they brought together – we were called out-of-the-box thinkers. They would take – it was like me and a director, and you know, it was almost like this kind of ragmatag – I don't even know how to describe it, but it was like this group of crazy people. It was really what we were. And they would give me a target of a major city like Detroit, and we would have to destroy it within an hour. And you go home feeling terrified because you see how easy it is to kill us. But what I was struck by is, why me? Why do you pick a novelist or now, you know, a host of a History Channel TV show if you can have anyone on the whole planet? And I traced it back to a guy named George Washington. When he was president, this is all true, had his own secret spy ring made up of regular, ordinary citizens, because George Washington used to believe that no one looks twice at an ordinary person, and they could therefore infiltrate and get information moved quicker than anybody. And I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if you found out in my next thriller that George Washington's spy ring still exists to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? Hmm. And I was like, that's a good idea for a book. So that's what the Culper Ring is. And each book that I write has this modern-day Culper Ring that does work for the president of the United States and does work, does that very work today to keep the country safe.
Brad, I'm wondering if you'd be so kind as to read us an excerpt from the very, very beginning of The President's Shadow. This is where the First Lady, Shona Wallace, is out working in her secret White House garden, and she's trying to keep up with a hobby that she has loved since she was a young girl.
Of course. She never told reporters she was a gardener or tried to use it for political gain. Somehow that would ruin the purpose. No matter where life took her or what a critic said, they had ripped her apart for gaining weight during the first year of her husband's presidency, the freshman 15 first lady, they called her. Here was the one patch on the entire planet where Shona Wallace, wife of the president, could run things just the way she wanted to. Gotcha, the first lady whispered, gripping the buried tree root and pulling hard. God, the cold March dirt felt good, and it smelled so fresh, full of promise. Winter had put so much on hold. She loved getting back to work in the earth. With a sharp tug, the root began to yield, though not by much. Leaning on her left elbow and probing blindly into the dirt, the First Lady felt, tunk, something solid, not a rock. The root felt weird, almost soft, spongy. She turned and pulled a penlight from her toolkit, shining it into the hole and squinting down to see what was in there. Under the dirt, it looked light gray, but as she pulled it closer, it was greenish blue with a tint of pink, like skin. A hiccup erupted from her throat. The spongy root had, those weren't branches. It had fingers, four fingers, squeezed in a fist, an arm. Oh, God, someone was buried in... Stifling a scream, the First Lady dropped the penlight, which fell into the hole. She jumped back, scrambling, crab-walking away from the pit. The press and early staff would be here any minute. Her body was shaking. Just don't scream. Orson, she whispered, stumbling toward the west colonnade of the pristine white mansion. She was gagging and sobbing uncontrollably. In the rose garden, the penlight still rested in the open hole, shining its little spotlight on a dirt-encrusted hand.
That is writer Brad Meltzer reading from his latest novel, a political thriller called The President's Shadow. And Brad, I always read acknowledgments, and it is not often you look through a writer's acknowledgments and read special thanks to President George H.W. Bush and First Ladies Barbara Bush and Laura Bush, which certainly gives your Inside the White House story quite an impressive imprimatur. How and when did the association with the Bushes begin?
You know, at the start of my career, I got a letter from President Clinton, and then I got a letter from President Bush Sr., as you said, H.W., President 41, just saying they liked the books. And Bush had written me. I actually thought the letter was fake because when I used to be an intern for the Senate Judiciary Committee all those years ago, we used to take the pen signing machine and the Senate Judiciary Committee stationery, and we used to write letters to our friends, tell them they were being deported. And that works, too. That really works, too. But so I thought it was fake and a friend playing a joke back. And I called the office and it said that he liked my novel, The Millionaires. And I said, yeah, someone wrote to me. And they said, oh, you got the president's letter. And I was so struck by the fact that here's a former president, the leader of the free world one day, and the next day he has to just stop at red lights like the rest of us. And I said to him, can I come see what your life is like? And for reasons I still cannot explain, he said, why don't you come to Houston for the week? And I spent nearly a week in Houston with the Bushes, and I've been friends with them ever since. In fact, last week I went, they asked me to come celebrate Barbara Bush's 90th birthday. They invited four authors to raise money for literacy. It's a bipartisan event just to raise money for a good cause. And I was one of the authors that was up there in Kennebunkport. And it's just a really a humbling but really respected friendship. And every book since, he's helped me with different little details. And I don't ask him, you know, hey, is the White House flower shop on the right side or the left side of the room? I don't do that. I can make up whatever I want. It's all fiction in my thrillers. But there's nothing like having the opportunity to ask one of the few people on this planet who actually lived in that space. And especially for this book, Barbara Bush and Laura Bush both, it was great to have the insight of their lives, especially as I was going to open the scene with the First Lady in the Rose Garden.
You know, you made some very big headlines in the last few days here and in Europe when you revealed your discovery that Ronald Reagan packed heat. He carried a gun when he was president after his assassination attempt. But I'd like to get to something else you discovered that I think really reminds us these are real people who sit at that desk in the Oval Office and that the instincts of real people can override bipartisan divides. Can you tell us about the notes in the desk drawer?
Ronald Reagan, when he left office, famously wrote a note that said, don't let the turkeys get you down. And he put it in the Oval Office desk and left it for George H.W. Bush. And when Bush left office, he wrote a note for Clinton, left it secretly in there. And Clinton left one for W., who left one for Obama. It's the greatest hidden tradition of the modern presidency. And when I was researching the Culper Ring and thinking, wait, we're going to have this secret spy group that helps every president as the presidency goes along, I needed a way for them to transfer the information. So I wrote to former President Bush Sr. and I said, could you move information in those secret letters that President Reagan left to you and that you left to Clinton? And I opened up my email and the email just says, the president wants you to have this. And attached to the email, President Bush had sent me for the first time ever, no one publicly had ever seen it, the letter he secretly left for Bill Clinton. And Bush famously always kept a copy of all of his handwritten letters, even the handwritten ones. Mm. And he sent it to me. And when I got it, I was like, oh my gosh, it must have a secret code. And I checked it for Freemason codes. I checked it to see if the third letter of every word spelled out, I hate you, Bill. I was like, what's in this thing? But the reality was it was just this generous, encouraging note from one man to another. And it just was heartfelt. And you could feel in a strange way, the only thing that he mentioned twice, President Bush mentions twice to Clinton, is the press. And you could just feel the sting that the press has for you when you're taking that public beating every day. And you could just, it was exactly what you said. It's one of those moments where instead of seeing a president, you see a human being.
Brad, you're coming to Michigan next week for the Everyone's Reading events in Rochester Hills and West Bloomfield. And I'll be hosting the conversation and question and answer session with you Monday evening in West Bloomfield in Oakland County. And this event is hosted by a whole group of public libraries. And you've been quoted as saying, without librarians, I wouldn't be an author today. Talk a little to us about why you believe libraries and librarians are important to us.
When I was growing up in New York, we didn't have a lot of money. And we never had hardcover books. The first hardcover book I bought was after I graduated the University of Michigan that I bought for myself because I didn't have the money for it. The one thing I did have was I had a library card. My grandmother, I remember, took me to her library in Brooklyn, and the librarian took me to this kids section, and she said, here's your section. And I literally thought she meant this is mine, that they were all mine. And that moment changed my life, and I suddenly met great friends like Judy Blume and Agatha Christie. And this whole world opened to me that I would never thought I would ever get to visit or otherwise know. And I just started reading. And I remember even going, not even checking out books all the time, but just reading them in the library and just enjoying that. I love that. I love librarians for that. Every time I meet a librarian, I tell them how important they are. And I can say whatever I want. I love librarians so much that the hero of my last three books is an archivist, basically a librarian who loves this information. Other thriller writers may pick former Navy SEALs who can punch people. Beecher White, the hero of my books, he can't punch. He can't fight. He doesn't know how to fire a gun very well. But what he loves to do is read, and he has a bigger brain than anyone. He is just smart. He's smarter than all of us. And I love that librarians all across the country are like, you made us heroes. And I'm like, you deserve to be heroes. You are.
And I know you're involved in a campaign to get Americans to contact their lawmakers and tell them to keep libraries funded. Are you worried about the future of libraries?
I am when the funding gets cut like that. I mean, I live in Florida. In Florida, we just had a go-around about 6 months ago where they were going to close, I can't tell you, some of the biggest libraries in the worst neighborhoods. And when you do that, you're taking away a lifeline. I mean, that's a place where people go and look for jobs and do research. You know, not everyone has a nice brand new computer in their house. And they forget that even that use, forget about the books and the value that brings. Let's not even get into that, which is a given, but just what a public resource it is. And when you crush that and you cut the funding, and people say, oh, what do you need books for? You have the internet now. Well, you know what? Some people don't have the internet now unless they have a library. So anytime I see any of those causes, we immediately jump and we'll put that on our Facebook page and Twitter. And the one nice thing of having, you know, almost 100,000 people on there is you can really motivate a group really quickly to see what politicians are doing and where they're trying to cut money from.
You know, I have to say, Brad, Michigan must have really left its mark on your heart because you do work in a secret Michigan mansion in every one of your books, don't you?
I do. In the beginning, it was great because no one knew about it. It would just be, you know, some character would be wearing a Michigan shirt here or, you know, a character would mention that he, you know, lived in Michigan here. But I always put a Michigan reference in. And then in the last three books, I was like, you know what? People are starting to catch him so easy. I'm not going to hide it anymore. And I just made the president of the United States went to the University of Michigan. I was like, you know what? I'm not even going to hide it. This is it right in front. So I took the big man himself and put him there. But yes, I do put a Michigan reference in every book. You got to find it.
Brad Meltzer, his latest political thriller out this week called The President's Shadow. And we look forward to welcoming you back to Michigan next Monday for the Everyone's Reading events in Rochester Hills and in West Bloomfield. I will see you Monday night in West Bloomfield. Brad Meltzer, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Can't wait.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.